Global roaming is expanding to keep pace with your world.
Because keeping up can be a challenge.
And events can feel overwhelming beyond our understanding.
What might Xi Jinping do next?
What hand is Trump hiding?
Join me, Hamish McDonald, Geraldine Doogue, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Four voices bringing perspective, experience and energy to the big global stories.
Global roaming. Weekdays at 11 on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. It might have been a while since you felt it, but remember that joy of going to the letterbox and seeing your name and address written in familiar handwriting, ripping it open to find a note from someone you love. Well, the boss of Australia Post has confirmed it will eventually abandon its letter service. So what does a post-post world look like? Also ahead, workplace behaviour has been in the spotlight this week after the public falling out between Kyle Sanderlands and his co-host Jackie O. But this isn't just celebrity behaviour. Most of us will have had to deal with a toxic colleague at some point. What do you do if that's happening to you? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, do you pay attention to unit prices at the shops? Are you one of those people that knows the exact time your local supermarket starts to mark things down so you can swoop in and grab a bargain? Well, what if supermarkets started using those same tactics on you? Changing prices minute by minute, depending on the time of day and demand and maybe even how quickly something's selling? Until now, that has been hard to pull off. Reprinting paper price tags takes time, it costs money, it's clunky, but with the rollout of electronic shelf labels, those little digital screens you might have seen replacing paper tags, prices can be updated instantly across an entire store at the push of a button. The concept is called dynamic pricing. We've seen it at play at concert tickets, ride sharing, and flights. So, is it a bad thing? Could it actually mean better deals in some cases? And how realistic is it that you'll see it rolled out at your local shops in the near future? Well, someone who has been looking into this is ABC technology reporter James Pertill, who joins me now. G'day, James.
G'day, Tegan.
Is dynamic pricing legal?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just matching supply and demand, a bunch of other variables, and changing the price in real time rather than using a fixed price. So it's perfectly legal as long as you're not discriminating on the basis of race and gender and a few other things and you're not being misleading.
So one of the things sort of that underpins the idea that this could be coming online in Australia is electronic shelf labels. How common are they around Australia at the moment?
Woolworths is going to entirely transition within the next few years. They've done millions of tags in hundreds of stores already. Bunnings is trialling it. Aldi is doing the same. Coles is piloting it. Endeavour Group, which is BWS and Dan Murphy's and that, they've entirely switched over to digital price tags in Dan Murphy stores. So it's very common. I've heard estimates that maybe we'll have about a third of retailers by the end of the decade using digital price tags in Australia. And right now it might be around just over 5%.
So you've spoken to retailers, you've spoken to small retailers as well in this article that you've written for ABC News Online, News Digital. What kind of things were people telling you?
Well, retailers are saying, look, it's great. It means that we don't have to change out paper labels, and that is a huge amount of work. I spoke with one pharmacist who's like, you know, every week we've had to come in early on a Wednesday to change out hundreds of paper tags. It takes 10 hours of staff time, and we don't have to do that anymore. We can change prices automatically. It saves on time, saves on paper, and it means we can be a bit more reactive to, you know, what our competitors are doing. And that's basically what all the retailers are saying. They're saying this is the argument for this is it saves time and it saves on paper, and that's why we're doing it. And then, you know, there's others who are saying, unions, for example, or US lawmakers or people who are selling these tags who say, well, yeah, it's good for that, but it also allows for dynamic pricing where you can change the price at any time and you can practice things like surge pricing or personalized pricing in store in supermarkets. That's not what's happening in Australia right now, and it might never happen, but the technology opens the door to that happening.
Also with me here is Professor Gary Mortimer, who specialises in retail marketing and consumer behaviour at the Queensland University of Technology. Gary, how likely do you think it is that we would see dynamic pricing in Australian supermarkets?
I don't think we'll ever see dynamic pricing in the context that a supermarket can push prices up or down sort of any sort of hourly or sort of, you know, 2 or 3 hour sort of time frames. What we might see, though, is sort of personalised pricing. I know James sort of touches on this on that article that came out. And that might be operated using near-frequency communication. So a beacon-style asset that sits on a shelf as well. You can imagine walking into your local supermarket, you turn on your loyalty app. As you wander around the aisles, near-frequency communication beacons, so eye beacons, estimate beacons, will detect that I'm standing in front of, the ice cream aisle, and it will go, listen, Gary, you're a valued shopper, so we're going to give you a discount or a lower price, a personalised discount for you to reward you for your loyalty. So I don't think we'll ever see sort of prices surged up, because of difficulty in getting supply, and we only need to reflect back on the pandemic where we couldn't get hold of dry rice or pasta or toilet paper, but the prices never went up.
The idea of personalised pricing, Gary, feels more sinister to me in some way because it feels like the opposite of that Australian idea of a fair go.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when we talk about loyalty as consumers, we all want to be, treated as individuals. A lot of the discussions around how do we personalise offers so that we're not sending someone an offer that they're not going to actually accept, and we're wasting time. A lot of the discussion, particularly around AI more recently, is how can we actually create personalised shopping experiences? And using sort of, estimates or eye beacons or beacon technology tied to your smartphone, so connected to your Bluetooth, a soft Bluetooth, it enables retailers to identify where I am within a store, how loyal I am, how frequently I visit, and that enables them to reward me at a point of time, whereas now I'm currently getting sort of offers for dog food and I don't have a dog.
Right. So, James, this is all a bit of a hypothetical conversation because, as we have said, well, Gary says that he doesn't think dynamic pricing is going to come to Australia. We haven't seen the personalised pricing thing happen here, but it is something that you're starting to see overseas.
Yeah, and look, as one industry sort of person said to me, no one knew about surge pricing until we got Uber, and now we're very used to the idea of surge pricing. So if the only thing that's, restraining retailers from bringing in some of these more sophisticated dynamic pricing strategies is the consumer backlash, well, those consumer expectations can change over time. And yeah, we have seen that a little bit overseas. The example that's often cited is this Norwegian supermarket chain that changes their prices hundreds of times a day, and they're using electronic shelf labels for that. In the US, there's lots and lots of talk of big retailers using these strategies in really exploitative, price gougy ways, to the extent that one of the big unions there and US lawmakers, Democratic Party lawmakers, are pushing for a ban on digital price tags in large grocery stores. And there's actually a bill in the US Senate to do that right now. It hasn't passed. So there's enough concern about, big retailers finding ways to essentially use technology to gouge consumers. And I'd say that is some level of personalized pricing where you have to pay more. It already happens online when you go and book flights or things like that, where they use your browsing history and other data about you to kind of estimate the most that you're going to pay. Now, you might argue that in-store retail is a very different space, but it's a slippery slope, right? Like, we got used to the idea of paying more for flights based on our identity. Maybe that could happen in supermarkets.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with James Pertil, a technology reporter with the ABC, and Professor Gary Mortimer, who's a retail marketing and consumer behaviour expert at Queensland University of Technology. We're talking about electronic labels in supermarkets, the fact that they could be the door to more dynamic pricing of our groceries. I'm asking what you think about this idea of dynamic or personalised pricing in supermarkets. a fair amount of dubiousness on the text line. Lots of people with one eyebrow firmly in the air. One says dynamic pricing and surge pricing equals just plain greed. I'm distrustful of demand pricing, says another, especially when there's a claim of high demand and so the price goes up because we don't have transparency of the demand. We'd be asked to trust the supermarkets saying the demand is high when they're not a disinterested party and in light of the current case against Coles. Gary, you said before we wouldn't see this in Australia, but as is illustrating by what people are saying on the text line, consumers have a pretty dim view of the big supermarkets at the moment. The ACCC has accused the big two of ripping off customers with fake discounts. Why should we trust that they wouldn't do something like this in the future?
Yeah, I accept that, Tegan. I think where we may see dynamic pricing operate within a supermarket, or for that matter, sort of a retail business, would be, as James alludes to, a sort of competitive threat. So the supermarket across the road suddenly puts Coca-Cola on special. They can instantaneously meet that price or beat that price. Or it could be in the fresh produce department or in the meat department where we've got products that are coming short in life, or we need to sell them out before best before date. So rather than trying to find those products and then physically change paper labels, they can instantaneously reduce that price as a reduced price to clear through the old inventory before it runs out of date, and then it replenishes that night and the original price goes back up. I think though how it plays out in a physical setting becomes incredibly difficult. Imagine standing there in front of, say, the biscuit aisle, and there's myriads of customers walking behind you, and suddenly the price starts to change. or the challenges of actually selecting your favourite chocolate biscuits, and by the time you get to the checkouts, the price is different. So, from a legal perspective, let alone a reputational perspective, putting it in place is incredibly difficult, and I don't really think any retailer would entertain that.
James, speaking of the ACCC, you spoke to Alan Fells, who's the former chair of that commission. What did he say?
Yeah, I'll just say to what Gary said, I mean, it does make shopping a lot more exciting, doesn't it?
It's a race to the
if you're competing for those cheap chocolate biscuits. Alan Fells said, there's nothing essentially wrong with dynamic pricing, and surge pricing could be good for consumers. You could get good discounts, which is what Gary was referring to before. He was concerned about the personalised pricing, and his phrase was, open the door to that. And that would be unfair. And he said, look, this change, this introduction of digital price tags might not notice anything for a few years. And obviously retailers are kind of judging how consumers accept this. But in the long term, it could have a very profound impact on what you pay for your groceries. And it could combine with other technologies. There's talk about, using facial recognition in stores and combining that with digital price tags. All of that's very hypothetical. It's not happening anywhere right now. But you could see the way it could be used.
Gary, are we maybe lobsters boiling in the pot here, just gradually getting used to this tech and it creeps more and more into our lives?
Listen, obviously, I think the way we're now shopping has changed fundamentally over the last 20 or 30 years. I was at a retail conference in Sydney last week where a lot of the discussion was about agentic AI. And already we're seeing now big players like Google and Amazon and OpenAI all investing in the idea that moving forward, shopping and commerce won't simply be browsed online. It'll actually be delegated to an agent. An AI agent will do the shopping for you. So, in fact, we actually may not be going into the supermarket anymore to buy our groceries. We may just simply say to Siri or Alexa, standing in my kitchen, can you please go and order my groceries for next week and have a conversation with my agentic AI, my AI agent, and it will go ahead and do that. And, of course, it will shop across multiple supermarkets to find the lowest price, and it will give me information on, for example, if I buy this brand of margarine versus that brand of margarine, I'll get an extra 400 points on my loyalty card. So I think, James is right. The technology is emerging. 15 years ago, I was in Paris seeing these types of digital labels. They're just entering Australia now. So we're certainly always well behind the rest of the world when it comes to tech. But I think the future is exciting. I think it's going to be more efficient for us to shop in the future.
Yeah, if I can send my AI agent off to do my grocery shopping, maybe there's more time for me to create beautiful art and hopefully not just spend that time doom scrolling. James, what kind of checks and balances?
I'd love to see this art too.
maybe you can subscribe to my channel. It has a cover charge and everything. James, what sort of interventions do we maybe look at putting in now to protect ourselves from a dystopian future that we're maybe fearing?
Well, one of Alan Fels' idea was putting an onus on retailers to say when you're getting a unique personalised price, which seems fair, right? You know, just a clear statement next to the price saying, you know, this is something that's based on your data that we've got collected about you. He thought legislation would be a bit too messy. You know, the ACCC has some role here to kind of say what's going on, but it wouldn't, you know, there's nothing illegal about any of this unless it breaches existing legislation. So I think his idea was a good one. I would just add that, you know, I spoke to Woolworths and to Bunnings and I reached out to other retailers and said, you know, will these digital price tags lead to dynamic pricing in store, surge pricing, personalized pricing? And none of them actually directly addressed that question. Mm. And none of them said, no, it won't do that, or we'd like to assure customers that won't be the case. So I think in their response, they've sort of left the door open to some use of that technology.
Gary, is there anything a consumer can do to protect themselves? Individually, we are weak, but together we are strong. Do we need collective action here?
Yeah, it's interesting. When we talk specifically about food and grocery shopping, it tends to be sort of a mundane, habitual activity. We don't invest a great deal of time into it. We are creatures of habit. We tend to shop the same supermarket. Of course, if you're willing to sort of shop around two or three different brands of supermarket, create lists using, you know, apps like Frugal to find the lowest prices and invest more time and energy, you'll save. You know, I think the addition of digital labels or electronic shelf labels really doesn't just change the way we shop. I think right now we're just simply enabling supermarkets to make price changes more efficient, more effective, and more accurate. And certainly the issue that's presenting in front of the court currently is related to some social media posts where old facing tickets or old shelf labels were left in place, and that then sort of brought on a further inquiry into it. So I think it comes down to safety and numbers. I think we need to see the tags as exactly what they are. They're just a modern version of a paper tag. They've been around in Europe for at least the last 15 years that I've seen.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, James and Gary. James Fertil is ABC's technology reporter. You can read his article on this on the ABC website now. And Professor Gary Mortimer specialises in retail marketing and consumer behaviour at Queensland University of Technology. Thank you for your texts too. David says, remember the hoo-ha when barcodes came in and many people said we'd be ripped off? Does anyone object to barcodes now? Dynamic pricing is inevitable. In a similar vein, another person says, when barcodes and scanning were brought into Australian supermarkets, there was a worry among consumer groups that this would cause the mispricing of items. To deal with this, the major retailers signed up to something called the Scanning Code of Practice. Will supermarkets agree to a new code of practice around pricing, one that doesn't deliberately profiteer from artificially created price spikes. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, Australia Post has warned there will come a day when it delivers its last letter. So what do we lose if the art of the letter dies out?
In 2026, the ABC will be talking to Australians from all walks of life in a series of national conversations. I'm David Spears, and I hope you'll join me for the first ABC National Forum, where I'll hear from Jewish Australians about belonging, overcoming hatred, and their hopes for a brighter future.
ABC National Forum, Monday, March 9, on ABC TV, ABC iView, and simulcast on ABC Radio National.
When was the last time you went to the mailbox and opened an envelope that made you smile? Because for most of us these days, it's usually bills, junk mail, boring letters from the bank, maybe a neighbourhood notice or two. Well, Australia Post says the volume of letters we're sending has dropped off a cliff. It's now at levels not seen since the late 1930s. And it's become so expensive to maintain the service that gets them to our door that it's only a matter of time before it's phased out. As Australia Post Managing Director put it last week, eventually there will be a day when we'll deliver the last letter. So, What does a post-post world look like? And will we miss letters? Well, you're about to hear from a logistical expert on what's going on here and a librarian who's been scouring through the archives for the letters that tell our history. But I want to hear from you too. I would love to hear about a letter that means something to you. Maybe it's one you sent or received. Tell me the story of your special letter and why it's special to you. With me is Paul Alexander, an Associate Professor of Supply Change Management at Curtin University. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell me what's going on here. Why has it become so expensive for Australia Post to deliver our letters?
The thing is that even though it's nice to write the letter, once you drop it in the box, it has to drop into a nationwide network, and that means that there are thousands of post offices and there are, I think, almost 13 million places that you could drop that letter, and the network that Post runs has to be able to deliver that letter now within 2 days, anywhere that you care to name it. So to maintain such a large network, and there's trucks and machines and sorting areas and post offices and so on, requires a large amount of money. So if you start taking letters out of the system, you still need a minimum size for that network to operate. And if you keep dropping the number of letters going into it, the cost per letter starts rising exponentially.
It seems wild to me that it could be profiting, even though we're not sending as many letters as we used to. Online shopping is huge. We're getting stuff delivered all the time. Is there not an economy there?
There is, but it's not a 100% economy. So even though you may, the parcels may end up in the same building as the letters end up, the machines that deal with them are completely different, and the people that operate them are separate. So we do need to, I mean, there's some economy, but there's also a whole range of things that work only for letters. There are also different community service obligations that Post meets for letters versus parcels. So yes, there is some economy, and the postie delivers those little three-wheelers are they're set up to deliver parcels as well as letters, but mostly parcels. So yeah, we're getting some economies, but not enough. It slows the decline, but not doesn't stop it.
So letters are becoming more expensive to send. What would how much would my stamp cost if I was going to actually cover the cost of my letter?
I was trying to do that maths quickly. So here's what I can tell you, that Post lost $230 million on the letters alone. It sent about it sent still quite a large number of letters, probably about 1.6 billion. But the thing is that every single letter it sends, it loses money on, and it will lose more. It's been going up quite a lot every year. So every time you send a letter, Post loses money. It's gone for a price increase, or it's going for a price increase from 170 to 185, and that won't cover the costs. That's because that's the highest increase that Post feels it can justify for the public.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm chatting with Paul Alexander, who's an Associate Professor of Supply Chain Management at Curtin Uni, about the fact that the boss of Australia Post has hinted at a future. He hasn't put a time frame on it, but that it's coming when Australia Post will deliver its last letter. And I'd love to hear from you about a meaningful letter that you've written or received. My number is 0418 226 576. Anne says my grandchildren write to me and I write back. Lisa says I still send birthday cards and Christmas cards. I'll be very disappointed if I can't do that anymore. Well, also with me here is Roxanne Missingham, who's the Chief Librarian at the State Library of Victoria. And Roxanne, even though we might not be writing as many letters as we used to, there are thousands of letters in your archives. Why are they so important as part of the public record?
Oh, what a good question. So we have letters going back to the very early 1800s, and they really tell the story. We collect them to tell the story of people in Victoria, in Australia. Their lives are recorded in a way that is incredibly sincere and open and gives insights you never get in publications such as newspapers. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about a story of a letter from Christine McRitchie, who came to Australia, to Melbourne, in 5th of June 1848. She came from Fife. It was a very long way to come by a boat, and she writes back to her families regularly. And when she arrives in Melbourne, she finds a position as a housemaid, and she writes this wonderful letter to her father to say, "We have good situations, the housemaids have no grates to clean, and the work is light here. But the most important thing that stands out to me is," she says, "the mistresses are not so sassy." Isn't that wonderful? So there's something about letters and the way it reaches to our heart, and we can express ourselves so sincerely, and they can change the world. We have letters like the jewellery letter that was written by Ned Kelly when he was arrested. He handed it over, more than 8,000 words, to explain the anger that he had, how he felt he'd been mistreated by the police, how he felt that particularly the Irish in Australia, and he was an Australian-born son of the soil, as he calls himself, was not able to have property, and his family were not treated equally. And that was one of the forerunners of a very serious inquiry into the behaviour of the Victorian police. So letters can really change the world, because you express yourself in a way that's not constrained by publishing. And I also love to receive letters from my grandchildren. And some of those are in family collections, from famous people to ordinary Victorians that sit in the State Library. And now some of them are on display in a wonderful free exhibition we have called Rebel Hearts.
Yes. Okay. I want to talk about Rebel Hearts, because this is all about love letters. Tell me about, do you have a favourite letter in that collection?
Oh, there are so many different letters. So one that's really moving is one that we discovered in the library. So someone had used the library as a post box. They hadn't had to go and get a stamp. And it was written in Chinese. And in 2009, it was found tucked behind a painting in one of our galleries.
Roxanne, do you know, I actually have an excerpt of that letter I can play to us right now. Here, let's have a listen.
"There were so many things I should have said when the moment was right, but now it's no longer the right time to speak them. Man, it feels like everything that happened was already written, destined. This story carries a sorrowful melody, yet still it is a beautiful story. Have you ever wondered, perhaps I was waiting for you for many years, and maybe across many lifetimes? If anyone were to ask when I fell in love with you, I'd say, the moment I opened my eyes, I already had. Or perhaps as long as I'd been breathing, I'd already been loving you."
Oh my gosh, Roxanne, this letter is so beautiful.
Beautiful. And we don't know if it was ever received by the person it was intended for. We don't know if the person who received hid it, the person who wrote it hid it. So it's a beautiful mystery, and really tells a different story of letters.
So that is the Rebel Hearts exhibition currently on at the State Library of Victoria, because we are talking about letter writing here on Life Matters today on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Roxanne Missingham, the Chief Librarian at State Library of Victoria, and Paul Alexander, Associate Professor of Supply Chain Management at Curtin University. I'm asking you about letters that you love, letter writing practice. A text here that has tears in my eyes. "My mum wrote to me on my honeymoon. I put the letter in my jacket pocket. I found it years later after she had died. Her handwriting was unmistakable. It was like a message from the grave." Well, Connie has called in. Connie, tell me the story. You started sending letters during lockdown.
Yes, hello. Yeah. I can hear you.
Tell me, good. I can hear you too. Tell me about your lockdown letter writing practice.
I'd already established a practice of sending postcards to my grandsons from wherever I was in Australia or other places. And then when lockdown happened, I thought, well, why don't I just send them from Sydney, even though we're both in the same city? So I started doing that. And the very first time that I could see them again after lockdown, my granddaughter, who at the time was only 3 or 4, got very excited because she had a letter for me. And the letter was a picture of her and me with my arm around her, because she couldn't write. But I just loved the fact that she'd got used to the idea of a letter. She called it a letter, what she was giving me.
Connie, that is so beautiful. I'm getting some most amazing texts as well. One says, I sent a letter to a woman I met in Colombia 28 years ago, and I went and saw her 3 years ago in Seattle. She'd kept all of them. People don't remember emails, but letters hold the soul of the sender. Roxanne, is that how you think of it?
Oh, absolutely. That's such a beautiful way to put it. There's something about the sincerity and the authenticity that reaches across families, generations, whether it's letters from people at war who are telling the story. And it's remarkable how many letters we have from ordinary people telling their families. And they were not censored. The stories and connecting other family members in a way that just so reaches to the heart.
Another here says, I belong to a copperplate envelope exchange. This ancient dip pen script is largely kept alive by this practice. Once a month, I receive a letter from somewhere in the world, usually a complete stranger. These are such special works of art. I understand this is a bit niche. However, my family and old friends all live on the other side of the planet, and a card and letter from them at birthdays and Christmas makes my heart sing. Same for friends sending them from interstate. How much would each letter have to cost to keep it viable? Your guest didn't say. What if post was expected to take longer than a couple of days? I, for one, would be willing. Paul, do we need to rethink our expectations of post if we want to keep letters alive?
Well, letters will always stay alive, and I think that we do have to rethink how we do letter delivery. I mean, Denmark, who has actually stopped their postal system, has stopped delivering nationally. But what that means is that if you want to send a letter, it then must be piggybacked along the parcel network. And so things will take longer. They'll go through various diversions internally, which you won't see, and they may cost more. So I think the model for sending mail eventually is going to work that way. There just isn't a need to have a network specifically set up to deliver mail. Oh, sorry, there is right now, but there won't be in due course.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. We're talking about letter writing. Kim has called in from the New South Wales far North Coast. She runs a letter writing community with hundreds of pen pals. Kim, tell me about your community.
Oh, hi. It's a beautiful community of women from all over the world. It's called the Lovely Letters Project. And it started just before, it was quite serendipitous. It started just before COVID in the end of 2019. And it started with me putting a call out on Instagram for a recipe swap because I was writing an ebook around recipes and childhood and memories and things like that. And 12 people applied and said, oh, yes, I'd love to write you a letter. And everyone was just stoked at this whole letter writing thing, you know. So I decided to make a free snail mail exchange for women in Australia, and then it became worldwide. And each month I match pen pals up, or, you know, members can have a permanent pen pal that they, you know, or a couple that they write to regularly. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful community of women who are sharing, you know, just everyday, simple, ordinary, small moments of their life on a page and sending it miles and miles away. And it's just, yeah, it brings so much joy to people's letterboxes.
What do people tell you about what they get out of it?
I'm constantly getting emails and text messages and DMs from these women saying how much joy it's bringing them. Like, it's a moment for them to just stop and, you know, they're predominantly women and they're busy and they're caring and nurturing for everybody else. And it's a minute for them to just pour a cup of tea and have a little sit down and enjoy, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of reading a beautifully written letter, you know, from somebody that they don't normally get to connect with. And I have quite a few women who are ill and, you know, at home, housebound predominantly, and some even bedridden. And I've had so many tears over the joy that they've felt, that it's like kind of brought back the joy to their life, because, you know, it's a way that they can connect with people and communicate again and feel like they're a part of something. And yeah, there's a gazillion things I could tell you about, you know, the joy that the letters bring people.
Kim, we're hearing Paul saying that sending letters, the cost is getting prohibitive. Maybe Australia Post might eventually stop doing it. There's someone in your community, though, who's maybe offering an alternative service?
Yeah, well, look, to be honest, I'm not sure if it's still running, but I think it was 2024. There was a young, gorgeous teenage boy who got on his bicycle and set himself up a little delivery service that outside of Australia Post that he ran within his community. So he was sending letters within the town as far as he could ride his bike. He was, and I'm not sure if he still is doing that. Yeah, on his own, off his own bat. And I think that's just a gorgeous thing.
Paul, are we going to see a horde of teenage boys on bikes taking over the gap in the market from Australia Post?
Well, there'll be some version of that, to be honest. There'll be people who, you know, when parcels got moving, there was a whole range of services that that delivered those.
Does Australia... keep going.
Sorry. I was just going to say, though, that there still is Australia Post network and it's still being used. I think there's 49 million people writing to each other still. 49 letters delivered. So that's a real market, and that market's not going to go away, and it has to be met because Post needs to meet its service obligations.
So it does have a responsibility to maintain this service?
It does. It just doesn't have a responsibility to maintain it in exactly the same way as it has been. That will mean that things like how quickly mail appears, how much an item of mail costs, those things will change. And it's just inevitable that it has to do that.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Roxanne Missingham, Chief Librarian at the State Library of Victoria, and Paul Alexander, an Associate Professor of Supply Chain Management at Curtin Uni, talking about the future of letters in Australia. We don't have as much need for them anymore. We're not sending as many letters, but you're telling me that you still love the practice of letter writing. One says, I've just finished putting a book together of my father's letters to my mum during 6 years between 1952 to their wedding in 1957. He was a student and worked in the country each summer. She met him as a 16-year-old. Mum kept them in a shoebox her whole life. I can hear their young, innocent voices before we knew them as parents. It's opened my eyes to them as excited youngsters falling in love, which lasted a lifetime. Another says, my husband died last year and was an organ donor. I got letters from the people who received his liver and kidney. It meant a great deal to have their connection to their story through their words. And Jenny says, each year I design a card to send out to 40 friends and family. I love the process of making each one, writing a message, walking to the postbox. It's satisfying to hear it drop into the bottom of the box, knowing it will be on its way. Sending a digital design won't be the same. Roxanne, what do you think we could do to keep the tradition of letter writing alive?
So I've got to say that these stories are so wonderful about the history that comes to us through letters. And I wonder whether there is something, particularly when I think of my grandchildren having the joy of writing by hand, whether perhaps there's a future where they write it and they then take a photograph and send it to grandparents. But there's still something about the physicality is wonderful, that is just wonderful. So maybe it's the adding the presence of a rock they've discovered or something else to cannibalise the parcel market. But I think it's something we really, really need not to lose. And I did want to just say one more story about a letter that shows how important letters can be. So Captain Moonlight was a great bushranger in New South Wales who personally thought he rivaled Ned Kelly. And his devoted companion, James Nesbitt, was a member of the gang. Captain Moonlight was arrested and ultimately hung in the 1870s. And he wrote 60 letters from prison to the love of his life, and also wrote to Nesbitt's mother saying, his hopes were my hopes, his grave will be my resting place, and I trust I may be worthy to be with him. Oh. And two women in Gundagai discovered these letters, because they were never sent, the prison kept them, in the 1990s, and petitioned the government for Captain Moonlight's grave to be moved from Sydney in Rockwood Cemetery to North Gundagai, where James Nesbitt was. And in 1995, they were united with graves next to each other. That was made listed on the State Heritage Register last year. And I think that says something about the power of letters to actually create a better society.
Oh, my gosh, Roxanne. Oh. Roxanne, Paul, thank you both so much for sharing your stories with me today. Roxanne Missingham is the Chief Librarian and Director of Collections at the State Library of Victoria, which is where you can go if you want to see this exhibition that's currently on. It's called Rebel Hearts, Love Letters and Other Declarations. And of course, Paul Alexander, Associate Professor of Supply Chain Management at Curtin University. Thank you for your letters to me too in text form. Carla says, a world without letters brings tears to my eyes. I still have one of the letters my dad sent me during his time in the Gulf War. It spoke of the sights he saw from the helicopter he was flying in and what it was like living on the HMAS Darwin. It was special, not just because I was missing him, but because it was addressed just to me. At 9 years old, that meant a lot to me. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, a public blow-up between radio hosts Kyle Sandilands and Jackie O has put workplace safety in the spotlight. How do you deal with a toxic colleague or workplace?
They're driven, distinctive and brilliant.
I love doing it because it's a great discipline.
Creative Types is back for a new season, delving into the minds of some of our most creative Australians.
Yeah, a ridiculous amount of fun.
They wanted to share an emotion or share a story.
Fantastic.
Like Andrea Lamb, Richard Hulberg and Nazeem Hussain. The new season of Creative Types with me, Virginia Trioli.
There's lyrics in here that I don't want anybody to ever see. Mm-hmm.
Starts tonight at 8:30pm on ABC TV and ABC iView.
Have you ever worked in a toxic workplace or had a difficult, even harmful colleague or boss? There's been a very public workplace spat in the news this week. You know the commercial radio duo I'm referring to, with a long track record of toxic workplace behaviour. But most of us have worked with a person like that. Nearly two-thirds of Australian workers say they've experienced a toxic workplace at some point in their career, and 40% of them end up leaving their job over it. With me is Aaron McEwen, a behavioural scientist, psychologist and workplace futurist. Aaron, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here.
What makes a workplace toxic, Aaron?
Generally speaking, it on one extreme, it could be that the place is physically unsafe. So, you know, there might be toxic fumes or unsafe equipment that people have to work with. But I think in the context of this conversation, it's more likely where people feel psychologically unsafe. So that could be characterized by things like harassment or bullying, where people are excluded, looked over for things like promotions or opportunities.
Is it a workplace culture that enables toxic individuals, or are some people just going to be that way no matter where they work?
Some people just are that way. They are kind of toxic. Most people are probably familiar with a term called psychopathy or psychopaths, is now referred to as antisocial personalities. They represent about 1% of the general population, but depending upon which study you look at, they could represent as high as 10% of executive populations. So what that kind of means is that you're probably more likely to run into one of these people at work than you are in your everyday life.
That is actually pretty crazy. I should be clear, we're not calling Kyle Sandilands a psychopath.
No.
But this idea of the sorts of people that you come across at work, 10% of executives, you're saying?
It could be as high as that, yeah.
What triggers or drives this sort of behaviour? What kind of personality traits are at play?
Well, often it gets referred to as what's called the dark triad. So this is a combination of kind of narcissism, where people are very self-obsessed and, you know, really interested in their own level of status. And what we call Machiavellianism, which is where they're kind of underhanded, a little bit sneaky, what you might call, trying to undermine people around mm-hmm. them. And then there's another component, which is the antisocial component, and that's where people might have low levels of empathy. They can be not inclined necessarily to check their behaviours. They can be impulsive. And at, you know, at the extreme end, where we see this in the kind of general population, a lot of those people with those traits might end up in prisons, for example, because they commit crimes. But in the context of workplaces, where people have these personality traits, where it's more high functioning, they might actually be driven towards positions of power and authority, places where they can manipulate people, where they are able to kind of stroke their own egos and have their egos stroked, but also where they can, dare I say, get away with some antisocial behaviours.
That's pretty wild to me. If you sort of think about those characteristics that you just described, they're not normally things that endear us to people. How are they rising through the ranks if they're like that?
Says a lot about organisations, I think. One is that not all, but some of them can be superficially, you know, quite charming. So they tend to be extroverted and we might actually warm to them initially. Someone like Carl Sandilands, for example, he's really quite lovely to watch on something like Australian Idol, for example. But then when he's hosting his radio show, you see something quite different. And so, yeah, to a degree, some people might actually warm to these people. They might have a degree of magnetism, what we would call star quality. But then there's the Machiavellian side, and this is where they might actually manipulate the situations around them for their own gain. So they're very good at understanding power structures and being able to utilize those power structures to get ahead, so to speak. And then, of course, you've got the antisocial bit, and this is where they might just ignore the rules. The rules don't really matter. Mm. And to a degree, that lack of empathy means that they're kind of happy to a degree to trample over others to get ahead. So that combination allows you to work your way through organizations quite effectively if you're in that high-functioning space.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Aaron McEwen, a psychologist and workplace futurist, about toxic colleagues, toxic work environments, inspired lightly by what's gone down between radio hosts Kyle and Jackie O over the last couple of days. You've mentioned executives, Aaron. Are there other particular occupations or positions where you see these types of personalities more represented?
Well, if we took just the antisocial component, there is some evidence that, for example, it's more common in surgeons, in lawyers, for example, often very high stress jobs where that ability to switch off and not be impacted emotionally and to be able to also take calculated risks allows them to be quite effective in those situations. But I think generally speaking, you'll find people with parts of these kind of personality traits all around you. So it's not uncommon to come across people that we might deem as toxic, which is a very broad term, in your kind of everyday work life.
So we have laws around psychosocial safety in the workplace now. Are they making a difference?
Yeah, I think they are making a difference. I mean, it's very early, so it's hard to get hold of definitive evidence that they're working. But I think one of the things I've certainly noticed is that the description of toxic workplaces seems to be kind of shrinking. You know, I think media, for example, is one of those areas where it was very common to find people with these kind of grandiose personalities. You know, it's about stars at the end of the day. Mm. So there are still some pockets of industries and certain sectors where I think we might continue to see toxic workplaces. But generally speaking, the laws that have been established, the way that organizations have committed to things like whistleblower processes and reporting processes means that, you know, the incidence of bullying and harassment and those types of toxic behaviors does seem to be coming down.
So let's say I find myself in a workplace like this. What do I actually do about it?
Well, I think this is the tough one. You know, in the vast majority of workplaces, it could just be simply reaching out to your HR department, discussing, you know, the behaviours that you're observing or that have happened to you, and then exploring what your options are. And generally speaking, in most organisations, HR is going to be there to help you. Or if you're in a unionised environment, it might be about reaching out to your union representative to get a similar type of support. But there are still organisations where the culture supports toxic behaviour. And I think if you find yourself in one of those organisations, it is actually a little bit tricky. Often the people that are, I guess, doing these toxic behaviours are in positions of power and influence. So there are always risks when you take on power and influence. So I think really have a look at your organisation, see what type of, you know, for example, whistleblower or the types of codes of conduct that might be in place, the values. And if there's a sense that those are strong and are likely to be supported, and you can look at the track record, for example, of how companies have handled things like this, then you're probably in a good position to seek support internally. If not, you might be on your own a little bit. And I think the fact that you mentioned 40% of people who have experienced this end up leaving their jobs, that's a pretty good indication of where things stand in a lot of circumstances.
Aaron, thanks so much for sharing your insights this morning. Aaron McEwen is a behavioural scientist, psychologist and workplace futurist. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Well, earlier in the program, I talked about dynamic pricing at the supermarket, and you had some strong feelings about it. The rollout of electronic shelf labels, those little digital screens replacing paper tags, there's concerns that prices can be updated instantly across the entire store at the push of a button, and what that might mean for us as consumers, whether you might see prices jumping up a little bit more quickly in the future. Well, someone who's been looking into this is ABC technology reporter James Pertill, and here's what he told me earlier.
Well, retailers are saying, look, it's great. It means that we don't have to change up paper labels, and that is a huge amount of work. You know, I spoke with one pharmacist who's like, you know, every week we've had to come in early on a Wednesday to change out hundreds of paper tags. It takes 10 hours of staff time, and we don't have to do that anymore. We can change prices automatically. It saves on time, saves on paper, and it means we can be a bit more reactive to, you know, what our competitors are doing. And that's basically what all the retailers are saying. They're saying this is the argument for this is it saves time and it saves on paper, and that's why we're doing it. And then, you know, there's others who are saying, you know, unions, for example, or US lawmakers or people who are selling these tags, who say, well, yeah, it's good for that, but it also allows for dynamic pricing where you can change the price at any time and you can practice things like surge pricing or personalised pricing in-store in supermarkets. That's not what's happening in Australia right now, and it might never happen. But the technology opens the door to that happening.
ABC technology reporter James Pertill chatting to me earlier in the show. I do recommend going back and listening to that full chat. It was very interesting. You can find it on ABC Listen. Thank you so much for your texts. On toxic workplaces, toxic bosses, one person says, I worked with a toxic boss who corralled me to a lesser job than my scope. For a while, I allowed him to do this and watched until I worked out what his personal currency was, then used that to flatter him until his defences dropped. He encircled me into the favoured group in the workplace. I was given full scope. We've worked together for 15 years. He still has no idea what I did. Earlier in the show, we talked about dynamic pricing in supermarkets and whether it's something we'll see coming here soon. HB says the only reason retailers would spend money on digital price tags is if they can make more profit. It will mean many lost jobs and more price manipulation to their advantage. Another says dynamic pricing, I imagine it will function like gambling. The house will always win. Or why would they bother? Jeremy in Rosebud says there's no way that consumers will get a better deal out of dynamic pricing. The only reason big retailers will develop and implement such a thing is to make more profit from us. And I don't see personalised pricing becoming a thing because it removes the constant prompt for people to sign up for loyalty schemes, seeing a lower price that they can access. We've also spoke about letters, and I asked you to tell me about a letter that meant something to you. One says, I lived with a friend and his daughter for many years. When she went away to stay at her grandma's for a Christmas holiday just a few suburbs away, she posted me one of her drawings in an envelope that she had scribed herself in her colourful and squiggly six-year-old handwriting. It was almost entirely indecipherable to an adult's eye, but the Australian Post posties still managed to figure out what my address was and delivered it just a few weeks later. It warmed my heart. I still keep the slightly faded envelope in a frame many years later. Another, hello, I have a letter from my teenage crush 30 years ago. In it, he said one day he would tell me just how much he liked me. Nothing eventuated back then as I'd moved away and we went on to live separate lives, but we recently reconnected. And so now after 30 years, he's telling me those things and it is so lovely. Stacey says, my daughter's friend once sent her a letter that was a postage stamp stuck on a piece of paper the size of the stamp with a small hello note on the back. The postie delivered it. So cute, and it made us all so happy. Well, that is just about all I've got time for with you today here on Life Matters, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal land. Tomorrow on the show, Beverly Wang will be with you again. She's going to be talking about your relationship with sex and how to talk about what you want in the bedroom. She'll be taking your calls after 9 a.m. tomorrow. That's Beverly Wang with you tomorrow. And I, Tegan Taylor, will be back with you again on Monday. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.